assault of top Democrat Nancy Pelosi's husband at their home has raised concerns that the U.S. could experience political violence right before the U.S. midterm elections. Why would there be an assault on the U.S. House Speaker's husband in the first place? Political polarity in the U.S. is so severe, at least that's how it's been reported, that most Americans think that the U.S. will actually have more political violence overall, leading to it to be less of a democracy. How the U.S. got to this mess and whether it can grow out of this political polarity is the topic of this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guests for this program. Activist and commentator Don DeBar joins us from Ossining, New York. And journalist and author Daniel Lazar joins us also from New York. Welcome to you both. Daniel Lazar, I'll first start with you. What reaction did you have when you heard about this incident where it's been described as a follower of right-wing conspiracy theories who wanted to kidnap Nancy Pelosi but went for her husband instead since she wasn't home and hit him with an axe, resulting in skull fractures and injuries to his hand and right arm?
Well, it was not an axe. It was a hammer. But there are still a lot of questions outstanding about the story. We're not really quite sure what took place. The police accounts have not been very good. But it seems that Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul, a very wealthy businessman, was attacked by someone who doesn't like Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi is third-ranking person in the U.S. government, just behind the president and vice president. She's the Speaker of the House, and she draws a lot of hostility from Republicans, essentially. So tensions are very high. The elections are just 6 days off at this point. And there's a feeling of violence in the air.
Yeah, exactly. We're trying to figure out in this program, if we can, how it got to this point. Now, Don DeBar, what we're looking at over here is Nancy Pelosi herself, as our guest there from New York said. She has been actually a topic for the Republicans, it appears. Her office was ransacked during the insurrection, and they were looking for her during the melee, as it was described. Why has she been such a target for Republicans based on what we're seeing here in terms of information out there?
Well, I hope, first of all, when you're using the term insurrection, you're putting it in quotes. That's what it's referred to as by some here, almost wall-to-wall the media. There was a protest march, and some rioters entered the Capitol building, sat down for a while. One of them got shot in the face and killed. This is really not distinguishable from occupations of various Capitol buildings by Democratic supporters and Republican supporters, for example, in Wisconsin. The context for this, A. Trap Brown said back in the late 1960s, violence is as American as apple pie. And he wasn't being glib. He was being a journalist, actually, reporting the history, or an historian.
How long ago?
The history of the United States. Polling data. If you go back, if you want to take some of the charge out of it, start back in 2014 before Trump was a candidate and suddenly his candidacy was a marker of fascism and violence and whatnot. Even then, the United States voting population and just the people generally were completely divided into two camps, two cohorts. That believe that the other, or the party that they support, is the root of all evil. These are very hard, ideological positions, and it's kind of weird calling them ideological because the fundamental ideology is almost identical. But this is a fact, and this is something that gets excited by politicians in the United States so that the unanimity of their opinion on major policy, like, gee, should we have a war with Russia, or should we sanction Iran, or should we sanction Cuba? Those things never come on the table. These two groups are encouraged to fight with each other over things that are of much lesser import.
But trying to get from the point where Nancy Pelosi is being targeted, Daniel Lazar, and then this gentleman or man shows up at the doorstep thank you for correcting me, with a hammer, even though the details are murky, as you said, and then he attacks her husband, even though it was said that he wanted to take her, as a hostage, and he was going to break her bones, from what we understand. Again, I know the details are murky. How we get in the States from that to this? She's being targeted politically, but then how do you get to someone going out with that intention, which involves violence?
Well, first of all, the January 6th, 2021 riot was really an insurrection. It had the goal of overturning the election results. Joe Biden, like him or not, had won by more than 7 million votes, but Trump and his supporters were determined to overthrow the election, to throw the contest into the House, and essentially stage a coup d'etat. That's what happened. Now, the American system is breaking down. It's 235 years old. We've had gridlock, in other words, utter paralysis at the congressional level for actually close to 40 years at this point. Maybe 30 years is a better estimate. Government is paralyzed. Passions are rising. There's a growing sense of civil war in the air. And remember, this happened before in the 1860s,
sure,
where Americans had a civil war. Roughly 2.5% of the population died in that conflict. An entire region was laid waste. It was a massive conflict, one of the greatest wars of the 19th century. After the Napoleonic period, I should add. There's no doubt that things are coming apart. This ancient constitutional system is disintegrating before our eyes, and there really is no way out of the problem. So, therefore, people are worried that, therefore, the coming elections will lead to a further increase in violence. And although the details are murky, as you say, it appears the attack on Pelosi's husband was an example of this rising tide of violence, this deepening breakdown.
Okay, Don DeBar, go ahead.
I can't get past the, and I don't want to litigate this issue for the whole program, but it's absurd to term this an insurrection and to certainly say that it was an intended coup d'etat. Let's say that this group of people, led by the guy with the horns and whoever else was among their group, were able to hold the Capitol building, say, for a month or a year. Does anyone imagine that they thought, from there, using Pelosi's phone, they could call the Pentagon and order a drone strike, or they could call the Office of Budget Management and have someone budget something for them, a limousine or lunch or whatever, or that they could call IRS and have them issue a check to someone? What exactly was the mechanism that was going to be used to seize power besides occupying the Capitol building? It's not just irresponsible, it's almost infantile to refer to it this way. And I don't mean anything personal to Dan, but that to me, that doesn't make any sense at all. You can't think this thing one sentence forward and hold that that's what it was. Now, given that, the situation in this country is more or less a media show. These individual incidents are characterized across a broad, basically a broad set of outputs that go into the brain of every person in the country, characterizing them in one fashion or another and inflaming these emotional, reservoirs that exist among two groups of people who watch media either MSNBC style or Fox style, where this is stoked on a constant basis. The guy himself is clearly a lunatic, okay? They did a jailhouse interview with his wife, who was in prison for 20 years for trying to kidnap a 14-year-old boy. This guy, there's allegations of him molesting his children. She says that he thought he was Jesus Christ for 6 months or whatever. This is not a marker, I hope it's not a marker, of the body politic in the United States or of the followers or adherence to any particular political grouping in the United States. This is a nut job that got his hands on a hammer, and whether he was invited in by Paul Pelosi, which is also one of the sets of allegations out here that's, unproven or not, or broke in through security that how do you not have security for the person third in line for the presidency, where somebody can just bust in the house at 2 o'clock in the morning? Whatever that was, it's not an indication that there's a group of people that are looking to seize the government in the United States, and that we have to somehow legislate ourselves, and what I hear Dan saying, maybe revise the Constitution in order to protect ourselves.
All right. The thing we're getting at over here is, Daniel Lazar, is the fact that there is this thing called political violence. And But the thing is this. Many perhaps are not aware that political violence is not just something that perhaps is somewhat on the surface, or maybe it's a one-off. Or, I mean, when you talk about it in the context of the U.S., it was quite shocking to see how that is actually something that has been going on for quite some time. Of course, it's been really highlighted based on Trump's tenure, and of course all the different reasons there, the biggest one being the fact that he didn't accept the election results. Now, what's more shocking are the way that the parties are dealing with, in particular Democrats and Republicans. And I'm going to go by polls because I don't have anything else to go by to make the point here. One of them talks about the use of threats. This was in Carnegie that was mentioned. By February 2021, 25% of Republicans and 17% of Democrats felt threats against the other party's leaders were justifiable. 19% of Republicans and 10% of Democrats believe it was justified to harass ordinary members of the other party. When I read this off to you, does this sound like it's something you believe? I mean, is this credible based on what I just read?
Well, it's entirely credible. Those are the perceptions out there. Listen, I don't want to get into an extended debate over what happened in 2021, but the goal was to stop the certification of the 2020 election results and thereby throw the contest into the House of Representatives, where the Republicans essentially have an advantage due to rules dating from the early 19th century. And so it was not an unrealistic strategy. And if the coup had succeeded, Donald Trump would have been declared president by the House of Representatives. And he might have taken office, but it certainly would have thrown things into turmoil. But political violence happens when political structures break down. When things are working smoothly, when you have free elections, when you have a party system, you have a parliament that is well functioning, et cetera, then people resolve their differences in a peaceful, civilized manner. That's the way it works. I mean, Britain has gone through three prime ministers in a matter of months, but there has been no fighting in the streets. I mean, it doesn't reflect very well on the British system. Has attacked one another. No one has made threats. There's no the political mechanisms are moving forward in smoothly okay. And efficiently. But in America, they're not. In America, they're falling apart. They're seizing up. They're freezing up.
Sure.
And they've been frozen for the last 30 years.
Hold on to that thought. Hold on to that thought, because I'd like to get Don DeBar before he shakes his head more to answer you. Don DeBar, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Just a point of clarification on the process that was underway on January 6, 2021. In the joint session, what happens essentially is a roll call of the votes from each of the states on their electors and how they were to be apportioned, and what had been certified by the state submitted to the joint house for them to vote on whether or not to accept it. In each case, if you have one member of the House and one member of the Senate raise an objection, this then forces the two houses to separate, go back to their respective chambers, and have a trial of fact based on the allegations that there was this problem or that problem. In fact, beginning with the A's, that process was begun, and that was when the Capitol was breached. That postponed the trial of facts that would have taken place, and it had been announced was going to take place on five other states, all of the swing states. There were questions that the ballots that were done by hand that were added to the methodology used for conducting elections in the year 2020 were not valid because they had not been authorized by the state legislature as is required under the U.S. Constitution. And as we know, those ballots were counted late, and they swung the election for Biden. What the people who were bringing these challenges hoped to do was to have a public trial of fact on television in each case, so that no matter what happened, they either scored their political points or they actually changed the outcome of the election under the due process of the Constitution.
Okay.
Now, the reality is the Republicans did not have a majority in the House of Representatives. So their strategy was not to throw it to the House thinking they were going to get Trump elected.
Could I interrupt?
Go ahead, sure.
The rules set forth in the 12th Amendment, which date from 1803, says the House would vote by state delegations. And the Republicans have a majority of state delegations in the House.
Pennsylvania.
So that's what I meant by the idea of the Republicans having an advantage. If they succeeded in throwing it to the House, they would have won. Donald Trump would have been installed in the White House for a second term. That was the goal of the attempted.
Very well. So let's try to get beyond this point here. And I have to, sure. Daniel Azar, thank you for that. But I'd like to go to Don DeBar and ask him this, because I asked you, Daniel Azar, about the threats that were thrown by both parties. Don DeBar, what we have here, based on this finding, again, where it summed up the idea, the notion of threats, it said 1 in 5 Republicans, 20%, and 13% of Democrats claimed that political violence was justified these days. And it put "these days" in quotes. And let me actually give you the source, so I don't just talk just to talk.
I've seen these studies.
This came the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace is where the source of this was. Now, what's interesting here is the fact that they think political violence is okay, and then they say that this is and then the Republicans stand out more compared to the Democrats. Why are the Republicans standing out more when it comes to the use of political violence, first of all? And second of all, why is that even, this political violence, being justified?
Well, first of all, if you look closely at the study, the margin of error actually consumes a lot of the difference between the two. Right now the Republicans are out of power. There's probably a deeper sense of frustration. If you go back to the time that Trump was president, the numbers were actually not quite so far apart. And if you look at, for example, things that happened around, say, the nomination of Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court and the protests that were outside of his house and some of the other things, there's been all kinds of political violence and it's kind of unfocused. It gathers around individual, incidents in the political realm, but it's not really a whole ideology that holds it together, where this is going to be the ideology of a revolutionary force that's going to change society. It's more on the order of riots. And here's the real thing. We're talking about, for example, this incident with Pelosi's husband, which is, as regrettable as it is, horrible as it is, I'm sure, for their family. Nancy Pelosi has funded for Ukraine alone, since 2014, billions and billions and billions of dollars, which have resulted in tens of thousands of people dying in political violence. The scale of these incidents in the United States compared to the imposition of political violence on the world by these same political officials, it's too ridiculous for words to look at them together.
Sure. I'm going to move on, since I'm looking at the clock and there are just a few minutes left here. Daniel Azar, again, I'm sorry to go by polls, but I'm trying to make a point, and I'm using the polls to come across here. The one was about threats. This is about the use of violence, where within the context of this source, do you believe the use of violence to take over state government buildings to advance your political goals is justified? Republicans, 13%, a quarter of the Republicans, and 13% of Democrats agreed. Okay, and then here comes what was shocking, 12% of Republicans and 11% of Democrats agreed that the assassination, in quotes, the assassination of opposing political leaders is justified to advance political goals. Does that sound like something that is believable, first of all? I mean, is that really what we're looking at in the political environment in the U.S.?
Those numbers sound correct. I think that's what I'm sure the poll was honest and accurate. I'm sure the people answered that way. And all I can say again is that the political machinery is breaking down. And when it breaks down, people don't have any legal constitutional recourse to battle these things out. They have no way of winning an argument, winning a debate, winning an election. So if the electoral process is stalled or broken, people have no choice but to fight it out in the streets. And that means violence, and that means assassination, and all
okay,
the rest.
Don DeBar, do you agree with that?
Yeah, and I'll point to something that illustrates it, I think, pretty clearly. For many years, polling data shows Congress somewhere between 8 and 20% favorable ratings among voters. And yet, the members of Congress have had for many years now in excess of a 95% reelection rate, which shows you that there is definitely a problem with the electoral system because it does not produce the outcomes that people hope. And in fact, most likely, I mean, you can only conclude, doesn't give them choices to change the situation that they're unhappy with.
So you mean that there should be more political parties? Is that what you're saying? That maybe that's one way of going about it?
I don't know what the mechanism is. I can tell you from my own experience running from office, running for office, that the system, and I hate that Trump contaminates the word by using it, but the system is clearly rigged. Anyone involved in it knows it. The people who administer the system are appointed by people that are gatekeepers for who the candidates are. Policy decisions are made by a very small group of people who then put candidates on the ballot and in office by consensus. And voters have really little to do with it other than to vote on which one that they want that's going to have a war with Russia and China or whatever, for example.
Right.
But how do they feel about abortion? How do they feel about gay marriage?
Okay.
Now, how do they feel about other issues that don't go to the heart of some of these really big issues?
All right. So down to the wire here. I want to ask you, Daniel Lozar, what you know about Marjorie Taylor Greene, because I'm looking at how, for example, she has repeatedly suggested support for Pelosi's execution and has, among that of other prominent Democrats, liked a Facebook post that said a bullet to the head would be the most expedient way to end Pelosi's speakership. I mean, is that what we're looking at when it comes to the real sentiment here and how that can translate into action by people who, Americans who are looking up to these lawmakers who are setting the laws?
Yes, 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 1,000 times yes. I mean, the system, again, is breaking down. Listen, the basic problem is that we have a 235-year-old system which is completely unchangeable, frozen in place. It can't be altered in the slightest, okay? The whole amending process is completely inadequate, completely frozen. It can't be changed. It's amazing. It dates from the age of powdered wigs and silk knee breeches, yet America is still stuck in the distant past. So, all kinds of ugly passions, fascist tendencies are rising to the surface. This is unquestionably happening. But the problem is, I'm sorry, I'm running out of time.
We're just fresh out of time. I'm going to suggest having another program on this topic.
Sounds great.
Because we can get at least more of Don DeBar in there also. But thank you both for your contribution. Don DeBar from Usening, New York, activist and commentator, and Daniel Lozar from New York, also journalist and author. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Yacoba Tapway and the team. It's goodbye until next time.